you may have seen is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Actors, right? The road to fame and celebrity. All right, I get it. You've had an incredible life.
Aren't you sick of hearing about them?
Me too.
The only problem is, I'm one of them. Except I'm not famous.
Oh, you've probably seen me. A bunch of times.
I'm the guy with the information about the hero's dad. I'm the doctor that can't figure out what's wrong with one of the main characters. I'm the guy they just punched in the face during the interrogation.
My name's Brian LaFontaine, and I'm a professional actor.
Oh, and it's not just me. There's a ton of us.
We're the ones you don't hear about.
Yeah, we're the names that scroll by at lightning speed during the end credits. But there's way more of us than there are of them. We're important too, dammit. Because without us, they can't tell the rest of the story. So this is for all the movie and TV prostitutes, homeless people, drug dealers, cab drivers, cops numbers 2, 3, and sometimes 4, the pilots, the waitresses, and girl at party.
This is You May Have Seen. Today I'm talking with Ned Van Zandt. This guy has pretty much seen it all. It's amazing. I could have listened to his stories for hours. He was almost Luke Skywalker for crying out loud. We talk about his personal ties to the movie The Iron Orchard, which is being released digitally August 6th. His sit-downs with Hal Ashby, improvising with Bryan Cranston, and so many more things.
I talked to this guy named Garrison. He says he knows you.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yes. Oh, I'd like to hear how that went. Yeah.
He said, tell Ned to put down the protest flag.
Oh, no. He would say that. Yes. Yeah. It is my, what do you call it, the bane of my existence.
I'm sure. So how are things in New York right now? You're on the Upper West Side?
I'm on the Upper West Side, yeah. Yeah. It's nice. It's starting to be summer. It's starting to get hot. I've turned on the air conditioner a couple of days ago. You know, summer's kind of low-key here. TV production hadn't started up, really, and so, you know, most people get out of the city, and I've never been one of those people. In all the years I've lived in New York, I somehow missed that boat of, oh, I've got a place to go in the summer. No, I'm always stuck in the city.
But New York City, like in the summertime, it's kind of the crazy season, isn't it? People go a little crazy in the summertime.
Yeah,
the heat gets to them.
Yeah, especially in my earlier days, yes.
When I was living there, it was one summer, I went in, I can't remember what month it was, but it was pretty much the peak of summertime, and I went into the East Village and was doing new headshots with a photographer, and there was a woman. Uh-huh. She was, like, when I say pregnant, Ned, like, she was about to pop any second.
Yeah.
And she wanted to pick a fight with somebody. She didn't care who. On the subway, like, she was going up and down the platform, yelling and screaming at nobody, and then she gets on the train, and she actually said, she's like, I'm going to fight with someone. And it's just one of those moments where you're going, just keep your head down, just keep your head down.
No kidding.
And she was so pregnant. I mean, of course, the human in me wanted to say, are you okay?
Yeah.
Is there anything that I could do? But I knew that I would probably get stabbed or cut. Yeah. Or
we've got a homeless guy, like, right two buildings down from me, who he lives in a little cubby hole in a doorway, and I guess he must be, because he's usually pretty clean and somebody must be feeding him, but he has, for the 3 years I've lived up here recently, he's out every morning haranguing. You know, he goes and he gets like his bottle of booze, but he's standing in the island of 79th and Broadway screaming at people. And I really wonder why he, you know, hadn't been shot by the police or whatever. He gets, you know, anyway. So it's comforting that he's out there screaming, and you know, so that still exists.
So Ned Van Zandt, where may we have seen you?
I guess most people say The Blacklist.
Okay.
I had a recurring role playing a character named Leonard Call, who was an ex-CIA spy, and his character was a kind of play on Harry Call, who was a character that Gene Hackman played in The Conversation, the film. Conversation, about a spy who, you know, goes underground, and that was kind of that seems to be what I'm most recognized for. Recently, it's The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Yes.
In the first season, I played Mr. Maisel. Michael Zegan is the actor. I played his boss.
Yes.
And so I get that more than anything from people. It's like, oh my God, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Yeah, I'm a little jealous that you've worked on that show. I absolutely love that show. It's amazing to watch. Oh,
it's great. It was great. It was a great set. I was thrilled when I got it. And I was hoping it. He quit my company. I was playing his boss, and right. When I read the script, I'm going, "Oh my God, I'm going to recur." And then he quit. So
that was
it'd
the
be
end
nice
of that.
If he came back. Yeah,
yeah,
but yeah. They're great. They're great to work for. Amy Palladino, and yeah, they're wonderful.
You have had a pretty colorful career. I am talking with Ned Van Zandt, who, just as he said, you may have seen him on The Blacklist, on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Marvel's Daredevil, the TV show Power, all the way with Bryan Cranston, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which I also love that show. I think it's great that you worked on that. Also, Nurse Jackie, Person of Interest, Weeds, Lost, Hawaii 5-0, Law & Order, of course. You're a New York actor. You had to do Law & Order at some point. Spin City, which was a fantastic show, and Coming Home with Jane Fonda and John Voight way back in the old days. Scandalous,
yes,
controversial picture.
Yes, yeah, it was wonderful. And I owe that to... yeah, go ahead.
And I was just going to say, and recently, the movie The Iron Orchard, which has personal significance for you, which we'll talk more about for sure. But yeah, say what you're going to say about Coming Home.
Well, Coming Home, I moved to New York when I was 18. I went to NYU acting school. Olympia Dukakis was my acting teacher,
right.
And I was there for a couple of years, and then I started getting work here in New York in soaps. My very first job was a soap opera called The Secret Storm, but then fast forward a year later, I got a recurring part on The Young and the Restless, playing a teenage alcoholic, and that was in Los Angeles. And while I was doing that, I got an offer to come to London to do a play called The Haunted Host by Robert Patrick, mm-hmm. who also wrote Kennedy's Children, which at the time was playing on the West End.
Right.
Anyway, so I was in London, I was 21, and I was doing this play, The Haunted Host, and one night John Schlesinger, the director, came to see the play. At the time, Midnight Cowboy had come out a few years earlier, and that was my favorite film. Anyway, I was just like, wow. And he said, if you're ever back in Los Angeles, look me up. And, I'd like to help you.
Right.
And I thought, that's amazing. So when I got back to L.A. a year later, I called him up. He invited me to lunch at Paramount.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, who would you like to meet? And I was like, wow.
Oh my gosh.
And at the time, I was aware that Roman Polanski was, this is before the scandals with him, and he was at Paramount. Robert Evans was running the studio. I wanted to meet him. Warren Beatty was casting some movie. I wanted to meet him. And mm-hmm. I'd heard that Hal Ashby was casting a movie about Vietnam. And I really wanted to meet him. And because Shampoo at the time was out, the film.
Right.
Anyway, he said, well, I can get you a meeting with Robert Evans. I can't get you Polanski. I can't get you Beatty. But Hal Ashby would like to meet you tomorrow at his house in Malibu Colony. And so I drove out to Malibu Colony the next day and hung out with Hal Ashby all afternoon. And that was my audition. He asked me about the Vietnam War.
Wow.
At the time, I was too young. I just luckily missed the draft.
Yeah.
But I was political, and my politics lined up with his. And anyway, long story short, I got the job. He actually filmed me talking. He said, talk about Vietnam. And I talked about my neighbor. I was living in Silver Lake in L.A., and my neighbor was a Vietnam vet mm-hmm. who had PTSD. He was damaged and a very funny guy. But I talked about Pete. And anyway, so that's how that happened. And I tell you, working on that film, I'm only in two scenes. They cut my big scene,
okay.
which happens a
yes.
lot.
Yes.
We know. but I worked on that film for a month, and I was thinking, oh my God, this is what making movies is like. You know, it's never been the same since, but it was magic.
So when you say it's never been the same since, are you talking about that actual experience or just filmmaking in general has changed?
Filmmaking in general, it's changed. You know,
yeah.
this was still a studio film. It was an independent, I mean, it was at the end of United Artists. And so Al was shooting, you know, I mean, God, I would love to see all the footage that was shot. But, you know, we would shoot everything and improvise stuff. And wow. It was just, you know, and go and watch dailies every day. We'd go on the Culver studio lot. He would invite everybody and we'd watch the dailies and hang out. And, you know, it was just, yeah, it was very special.
It does seem like you were able, you were an actor in New York and L.A. during what seems to be sort of a prime, very romantic, sexy time to be an actor at either one of those markets. Like, it really does seem like a lot of the way that it used to be that was so interesting and creative, it's no longer like that anymore. I mean, you don't hear stories like that, exactly like you're talking about.
No.
So how was that for you to just be able to, I mean, to have that happen? You're this, you know, kid from Texas.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was different in the sense, too, that at the time, I mean, when I look back on my earlier career, I think, you know, this is pretty amazing that, you know, I worked with these people. But at the time, this is before the Brat Pack. What I'm trying to say is there weren't a lot of roles for young actors.
Okay.
And it was tougher. It was most of the roles I went up for were Vietnam vets, soldiers. And this is before Happy Days. I mean, all that happened.
Oh,
and so it was an interesting time. The films I went up for, oh my gosh.
Right.
And the ones I didn't get, you know, that's a funny story in itself. I came in very close to playing Luke Skywalker in Star Wars.
Get out of town.
No, I was in London doing that play.
Okay.
And George Lucas was, I had a meeting with George Lucas in this small office. He was, you know, like this skinny kid. You know, yeah. I was a little younger, but I was given just some pages of this script, and I was told it was a space western. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it, and I said, "This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever read." And you know, I had this dialogue, and you know, it was a scene with Princess Leia, and I gave it my best shot, and he was very impressed, and I had a call back. And what happened was the project got delayed for a month, but it was, you know, anyway, so it didn't happen. I came close. I like to say I came in third, but I don't know if that's completely true, but it's, I got very close to that.
That's pretty interesting. I mean, like, I saw the photo of you, I think it's on your IMDb page from when you were on, like, the Nancy Drew Mysteries or something like that, and
oh, yeah.
Which is a great photo. I mean, you've got this wonderful full head of brown hair, and now that you say that, I'm like, wow, I can totally see you as Luke Skywalker, absolutely.
Yeah, the feedback that came back after my callback for Lucas and was that he thought I was terrific, but I was too worldly. World, too of this world, too sophisticated,
right?
And the role that they'd seen me in, the play I was doing in London, was you know I was playing this very kind of Machiavellian. I was playing a kind of a dark, you know,
sure,
crafty kid. I was not I was not the aw shucks of Mark Hamill.
Yes, I got you. I got you.
Anyway, it was a terrific time. It was before big agencies, and it was different, but it was a lot of fun.
So again, you're originally from Texas, right? From Fort Worth?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
You live in New York now, and you have lived there for a while. You've lived in LA. How long were you in Los Angeles for?
Oh my gosh. Years and years and years. About three different times. I moved to New York when I was 18. I went out to L.A. 2 years later. Then I was in London for 3 years. Then back to L.A. most of the 80s. And then moved to New York in the mid-90s. And then to Austin, Texas, where my family lives now. I went there to try to – I'm not sure what I was doing there. But, I wanted to get in on the film industry there, and that never quite happened. And then back to New York 7 years ago, but with two important forays to Hawaii. I lived in Honolulu twice.
I was going to ask you about that. Because it seems like you have some connection about it to Hawaii based on stuff that's on your resume, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I've done 14 film and TV projects in Hawaii. And that's what happened. I got a job working for a children's theater there in the late 80s. And Lived there for 5 years, then moved back to LA. And then in 2007, I moved back to Honolulu. I mean, I wasn't planning on moving back there, but I went back there to visit friends and got a job. I got a lead in a Lifetime movie just from being there during the writer's strike. I don't know why. They were going to shoot a Lifetime movie in Vancouver.
Okay.
And there was a writer's strike, and for some reason they changed locations and did it in Hawaii, and I was there and I got the job. And so I stayed, you know, and so I got a, you know, a job on Lost. And
now I looked up, man, there's all kinds of information about you and articles and interviews. And so it was nice and it was fun to be able to truly research you, which I don't always get to do with a lot of the people that I interview. You were a child actor at the age of 10 because of a production of The Music Man?
Yes, yes. My mother was a big band singer in the 1930s who sang with Eddie Duchin and Paul Whiteman. And she met my father. He was, we're from this kind of well-known family in Fort Worth. My great-great-grandfather was one of the founders of Fort Worth.
Wow.
And my great-grandfather was one of the founders of Fort Worth. My great-great-grandfather was almost the first governor of Texas, but he died a week before the election. And anyway, so the band's, you know, the oldest standing structure in Fort Worth is this cottage that's the Van Zandt Cottage. Anyway, my dad was like the scion of this family, and he met my mother, who was touring with Billy Rose and with the big band with Paul Whiteman, and they met in Fort Worth, fell in love, and she gave up show business. But this is a long-winded way of saying that's kind of where I got my show business bent, was from my mom.
Right.
And so I started acting at the age of 8, and I got my equity card when I was 10 doing a production of The Music Man playing Winthrop. And I could have had a career. I was offered the part of young Patrick in Mame on Broadway with Angela Lansbury, but my dad would not let me do it because he didn't, my mother would have had to move to New York. And my dad had this idea. He said, child actors become unhappy adults. And so I went, okay. Anyway, it was disappointing at the time, but then when I was 13, I stopped acting and tried to play football. But I started very young.
So then what made you pick it back up again?
I went to a boarding school in Lenox, Massachusetts, where my roommate was a fledgling playwright, and he asked if I would be in his play. And I did his play, and the bug hit again.
Yeah.
And that's when I decided I wanted to act. And so I applied to NYU and got in.
So, so talk to me then about, since you brought your dad into it, and The Iron Orchard.
Yeah, The Iron Orchard was a novel that my father wrote in 1966. My dad did a lot of different things. He'd worked for Gulf Oil Company. He was an oil roustabout. He later worked at the bank his grandfather had founded in Fort Worth. Job he really did not like, but he took just, you know, to provide for the family. Mm-hmm. But in his spare time, he wrote. Like every night, when I was a kid, he'd come home from work and he'd go in his study and write. And he had three novels published in the 1960s, and one of them was a bestseller called The Iron Orchard, which is about the oil business in West Texas. And it's kind of like Edna Ferber's Giant. Poor kid from the wrong side of the tracks is in love with the wealthiest girl in town. Her parents won't have it, and so they send him to West Texas to work in the oil fields. So the book came out. Every studio in Hollywood optioned it in the late 60s, but it never happened. It never happened. My dad died when I was 18. And then in the mid 70s, my brother and sister and I had the option. I had a meeting with Robert Redford. He was interested in directing the film. But over the years, it never happened until about 5 years ago. Ty Roberts, who's a director from Midland, Texas, wonderful director, he optioned it and got the film made. There was nothing in the contract or anything that said I was going to be in it. But I was interested in playing the role that Lou Temple played. Actually, I was interested in playing the role that Austin Nichols plays, but I'm too old for that. But that's like the character Jim McNeely, played by Lane Garrison, who's wonderful, his sidekick.
Yep.
It's this character named Dent that Austin Nichols plays. And when I was in my 20s, I wanted to play that part if it had been made into a movie, but that never happened. You know, so 5 years ago, I was interested in playing the role of Ort. They got Lou Temple, who couldn't be, you know, he's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Anyway, then the director reached out to me and said, would you be interested in playing the role of Lee McNeely's father, the female lead played by Alec right. Coburn. And in the book, this character is kind of like, he's kind of like the touchstone. He gives narration throughout the book about the oil sure. business and the nature. It's a wonderful character. And they managed to put this in the screenplay. I mean, it's yeah. a lovely, like, a cameo, I guess. You know, yeah. it's a wonderful, wonderful part. So I put myself on tape. You know, I wanted to make sure that I was, you know, in the ballpark. And he loved it, and I got the part. And yeah. and the film opened in February. It's going to be released, I think, I'm not sure the exact date, in August on DVD.
August 6th.
Yes, that's the date. Great. and what the, okay, so when I was shooting the film, you know, I do voiceover stuff. I've never done an audiobook. You know, I mean, I do voiceovers. But Ty said, I really love the sound of your voice. We're thinking of having you narrate through the movie. We're going to take passages of the book and do that. And so I recorded some of that. But it didn't make it into the film, you know, and I understand why, it was just pacing. Right. But they came up with the idea of me narrating the audiobook. So in January, I went in a studio and spent 3 weeks recording my dad's 383-page book, which I had to admit, you know, I read the book. I didn't yeah. read the book when it came out because I was 10. I read the book after my dad died, but not really. I would skim it, you know. Because I was supposed to have read the book. When the movie was being made, I read the parts that I was going to be in. And
typical yeah, actor.
Well, typical, you know, it was just this resistance to my father. My father and I had a very kind of contentious, but I mean, at the end, it was in the later years of his life, we got along, but I had begged to right. go off to boarding school to kind of get away from my dad. You know, I just really wow. didn't get along with him. And mm-hmm. until the last year of his life, we had kind of a meeting of the minds. But anyway, so when this audiobook thing came up, like over Christmas, I went, holy shit, I got to really read this book. And so I really, right. you know, dug into it. And it was quite profound because I had a lot of things I told myself about my father mm-hmm. turned out not to be necessarily true. That he was rigid, that he was, you know, just that he was... I thought he was conservative. I thought he was unfeeling. Right. But through really getting into this novel, you know. Anyway, so I got to know my father for the first time.
Yeah.
And
I mean, that's always the way, right? Fathers and yeah. sons, those relationships, man.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the play 3 Days of Rain by any
oh,
chance?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I did that show a couple of years ago. I mean, as you know, then that's a big theme of the play
oh,
is the relationship between kids and their yeah. parents. Yeah. What we assume they're like and what we project that the relationship is like or what they're like or where they're coming from and how in yeah. the end that's really never the case.
Yep.
That's just so interesting.
Yep. And so that's out on Audible now. And yeah, so it's kind of cool.
It's yeah.
all turned out. Yeah.
I mean, I got to think that was pretty powerful for you, certainly, to have that experience.
Oh, it really was. I mean, I never expected to end up in.
It's got to feel full circle in some regards, for sure.
Yes.
And that's so crazy that the screenplay or that the movie idea was able to really live that long and still be made.
Yeah.
I mean, that's unheard of as
yeah.
well. That never happens.
No. It's amazing. And you know, and I think the film is wonderful, but I think the book could be a miniseries. I think there's more to mine there. I mean, there's a lot of, I found, you know, in doing the audiobook, oh God, there's so many characters that didn't make it.
Yeah, I enjoyed the movie. I would love to read the book. I'm sure that's always the toughest part is that you end up having to lose so much in order to be able to squeeze it
yeah.
to within, you know,
yeah,
2 hour time
yeah,
frame.
Yeah, but they did a wonderful job. Well, they cut a couple of my scenes, but like I said, I'm used to that. And it wasn't necessary to the story.
More with Ned Van Zandt in just a minute. You're listening to You May Have Seen, proud member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. There are so many great podcasts on the network, and they're adding new ones all the time, showcasing great stories by great people and shining a spotlight on the Queen City. You can find them all at queencitypodcastnetwork.com. Shoutouts. I want to give a quick shout out to my amazing and wonderful friend, Paige Johnston Thomas. She gave the podcast a great mention on social media back in May, and I completely missed it. I'm the worst. Paige, you know I love you, and I'm so sorry I didn't see that fantastic post until just the other day. You are sensational. I really mean that. Thank you. I'm going to be talking a lot about the movie The Iron Orchard over the next couple of weeks because I'm really big fans of the team and actors behind it. This movie has so many You May Have Seens in it, and I want to give attention to at least a few of them if I can. Alan McLeod. This guy's great. He plays Barry Wakely in the movie. You may have seen him in You're the Worst on Hulu and Parks and Rec with Amy Poehler. Gregory Kelly, who plays Kep Bruner. You may have seen him in The Leftovers on HBO and the TV show Queen of the South. All these folks work their butts off to get this movie made, and I know that oftentimes a lot of people's efforts go unnoticed, so congrats to them for pulling it off. Okay, here's more with Ned Van Zandt.
So then let's talk about that. For this guy who has had this really, you know, wonderful career over the span of, I mean, not to give away your age, what's it been, 50 years, basically?
50 years, yeah.
So you've already brought up being cut out a number of times. So talk to me about that experience for you when that happens. Like, I mean, do you remember the first time that you got
cut out of something
you were really looking
forward to? Yes, I do. I was listening to your podcast with Kate Middleton, and she was talking about, you know, in the days before Facebook, you asked her if, you know, if she promoted stuff she was in. I think it was a Law and Order. You know, I've done several Law and Orders, you know, the old Law and Order, and and been cut out of several of them. But I think it was the first one. I sent out postcards, you know, actors used to do that. I sent out postcards.
Yep.
And I actually was home in Fort Worth at the time. And my mother, like, had this viewing party.
Oh, my God.
You know, people would watch me on Law and Order. Anyway, and I was cut out. I've been cut out of some wonderful stuff. I went to a screening. It's funny, an actress I know, who I won't name, was just on Facebook yesterday, who did this really high-profile movie and said that it was lovely that the director sent her a note and said, I'm sorry we had to cut your scene, but you were wonderful, and how classy that was. Because I've gone to screenings of movies that I was in, and I was not told that. And, you know, but it's just, it happens. But like in the case of the Iron Orchard in particular, an actor, you read a script now, especially like if I get an audition, I'll read a script and I'll go, is this going to make it to the, you know if it's going to make it. Because if it's integral to the plot, if it could be law, you know, things like that. And so, you know, with the Iron Orchard, the couple of scenes that were cut, it was like, oh, I wish that had been there. But I guess the first cut of the film was like 3 hours long, and they just had to pare it down, and it wasn't integral to, you know, the plot.
That's interesting that you say that, as far as at this point now in your career, looking at a script and being able to decide, is this something that I want to do? Is this something that I don't want to do? How important, in your opinion, is it for actors to either just take every opportunity that comes along or be able to feel comfortable and confident going, no, this isn't something that I want to read for or be a part of? Or
yeah, I kind of go back and forth on that, you know? Sometimes I say yes to everything because you never know. I mean, especially like in New York and L.A., especially L.A., a lot of times you get projects which are short films, projects friends are doing. I think I err on the side of say yes. I have said no to some stuff recently, and I've been happy I did it. I said no to some regional theater stuff just because I don't want to leave the city, although like that experience I had in Greensboro at Triad a couple of years ago, I'm so glad I did that, even though the, you know, money wasn't great, but I was glad I said yes. But just because you never know who you're going to meet and what's going to happen. So I tend to err on the side of say yes.
Yeah, I came across several things that you were a part of. I saw this great or fun little short film, I guess that you would call it. It was only about a minute and a half long with the bubble gum and the
mousetrap. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
And it seemed pretty recent, so I was like, it just seems like you're just like,
well,
hey,
that
gives me an opportunity to work on something, or it's fun, then why
so
not?
It's funny, because I was just texting that filmmaker. It's a young filmmaker named Paul Pissarro, who's the great-great-grandson of the painter Camille Pissarro, and he was a film student at New York Film Academy here, and he asked me if I would be in his, you know, short, and I said yes. And right now he's going on, and he's in pre-production for a feature. I mean, it's So you never know, you know.
I even ran across one of your auditions.
Oh, my God.
There's an audition of yours online.
I know, and I can't get that off.
You did a great job. I don't know if you got the part, but you did a great job.
Yeah, and I didn't get the job. But the auditions online remind me.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, it was a series regular if it's what I'm thinking. It was a series regular for a show shooting in Hawaii, and it was shot in New York during Hurricane Sandy. I really want to get that job in Hawaii. And anyway.
So how do you feel about that, the way that it is now with the digital submissions and taping your auditions and sending them off, as opposed to the old days where you would have to go in the room? I'm sure then that was, again, I'm by no means saying, hey, old man, but I mean, you were a part of the industry when it was be in the room.
Be in the room, and they were all in the room. Now you go in the room, and it's just, you know, the assistant and a camera.
Yeah.
And but I appreciate that. No, it's, I was complaining about this a lot lately. Yeah. Just because I'm not technically proficient with taping myself yet, you know, and so, but fortunately I have friends whom I pay. You know, I had this terrific audition last week. I mean, it was terrific material, and I went to my friend, and you know, we did it. But it's kind of like you have to, you're paying to act these days.
Yes. For everyone who is listening here, who, I don't know how you're not familiar with Ned Van Zandt. This guy's amazing. You should check out The Iron Orchard when it comes out digitally on August 6th. And if you're not watching The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, then I don't know what's wrong with any of you. Or Kimmy Schmidt, or so. And if you never saw Lost, so many of the things that Ned has been a part of. And is Daredevil, are you still on there? Is that still going on?
No, they canceled the show and they killed me. I got shot in the head. So, but that was fun. Oh man, I got to work with Vincent D'Onofrio.
There you go.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you never know. I mean, I've had several points in my career where I thought, okay, this is it.
Right.
You know, I'm set, or you know, it's whatever. Right. But it's all relative. One of my best friends was the actress Doris Roberts, who played Marie Barone on Everybody Loves Raymond. Mm-hmm. And she was never satisfied. She was never, I mean, after she won, you know, 4 Emmys, she'd get this job, you know, a great job. And her son, who's a good friend of mine, used to rib her, Ma, when will you be satisfied? And she was never, you know, never felt secure, you know. And so it's relative, you know.
How have you been able to keep it going for so long? Because, I mean, you seem like you always, you're able to get into something.
Well, you know, I mean, I've dropped out of the business a couple of times. And, and they keep pulling me back. and I've done other things. I do other work. You know, I drove a cab when I got to New York.
Now, have you ever played a cab driver as a result?
It's funny. I watched the filming of Taxi Driver outside of my apartment window. This is in 1973, I think. They were filming. I lived on 13th Street, and I was watching the filming of Taxi Driver. I didn't become a cab driver till 10 years later. But yeah, no, I just keep going, you know. And I've been lucky, you know. I do the deal, and I write now. I've written a play called Del Valle, which has been optioned by a Broadway producer, and so I think that's exciting. And
so, I mean, theater is obviously, it's a big part of your life. It's been a big part of your career. You were on Broadway in 1999 in The Iceman Cometh.
Yes.
That's a big deal.
Yes. Broadway's the hardest. I mean, that's a tough gig.
Tell me all about it.
It's your whole life. I mean, it's your whole life if you're doing a series, too. But you just really have to be in fighting shape. You know, The Iceman Cometh was a 4-hour play.
Wow.
I was in the last 30 minutes of that 4-hour play, and I also understudied 3 other roles. And so, you know, you just, I mean, every day I was kind of like, I mean, it's your whole life. I mean, I just marvel at people I know, like Danny Burstein, who goes from wonderful Broadway show to wonderful Broadway show, and he has a life with a beautiful wife, and he's able to do it. I just remember when I was doing that play on Broadway, it was kind of like, okay, I can get up and go to the gym, and then I got to focus on this. I mean, it's your whole life.
Wow, really?
Yeah, but it's so exciting, and so, you know, there's nothing like it. Yeah.
Now, how did that opportunity come along to you?
Well, I worked for 10 years as an assistant casting director and cast 22 Broadway shows. I worked for Jay Bender, who cast The Lion King, most of the Disney stuff, most of Neil Simon stuff. And I was working for Jay when he started casting The Iceman Cometh. And at one point, Howard Davies, the British director, turned to Jay and he said, Ned's better than most of these people coming in. Because I was reading for the...
Sure.
For, you know, all the... Yep, yep. Everybody in town. And we'd flown out to L.A. And he said, Ned's better than most of these people. And so Howard basically cast me. He said, I think Ned should play, you know, this part. And he should understudy Paul Giamatti. And so that's how that came about. And it was interesting because that was kind of like when I decided, okay, because I was known as an actor, but I was also known as this casting guy. And I love casting. I really loved it. But at some point I had to make a choice. I have several friends who are hyphenates, who are actors and casting people.
Right, right.
But I just had to make the choice at the time. But I've got a great eye. And I've got some great stories, which I can't go into here, but about actors, and actors that, you know, you get so much information. But also, I loved helping actors. You know, I'd see somebody, you know, in an off-Broadway play, and I'd say, you know, whether it was Jake Bender or Jim Carnahan, who I also mm-hmm. worked for at the Roundabout, I said, you got to see this person. You got to see right. young Jennifer Garner, who came into an open call.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, let's get her an agent. You know,
wow.
So it was great. But that's how Iceman Cometh came about, is through Howard Davies, who said, I want you to be in my play.
And did you just jump into accepting that opportunity, or did you have to take a little time because you were doing more casting at the time of like, whoa, am I ready for this?
Oh, no, I jumped in. You know, people ask me, you know, what should a young actor do when he moves to New York? Well, a young actor moves to New York today should check out Naked Angels, which is a group here in New York. From September to May, it's a writers and actors co-op kind of thing. Not a co-op because it's free. It's the longest running professional reading series in New York. And it meets in this bar theater on St. Mark's Place called Theater 80 every Tuesday night. It's called Tuesdays at 9. And so a young actor can go there and network and get a community and
wow.
get some jobs out of it. And so that's one thing I tell actors. But also to study, especially in LA. I'm always, when I'm living in LA, I'm always working with a teacher. You know, I studied with Milton Caselas, who was a great teacher. Mm-hmm. I studied briefly with Lee Strasberg. You know, I think Olympia Dukakis remains my best mentor influence.
Sure.
And I also was directed off-Broadway a few years ago by Bob Krakauer.
I knew Bob.
Yeah.
I took some classes with Bob.
Yeah, he's terrific. And so, like, I tell actors, you know, Who should one study with? I mean, Bob Krakauer is one of them.
Now, how do you feel? Because when I was in New York, the big thing at the time was the whole workshop thing, where, again, as an actor, you're paying to meet an agent, meet a casting director, meet somebody.
Yeah.
And it was just, it seemed like it was the only, even though it was costly, it was the only
yeah.
surefire way to be able to be seen by somebody in the industry, whether it was a waste of time or not. Is that
yeah.
still?
I haven't had to do that, or I haven't done that since in the 7 years I've been back in New York.
Right.
Prior in L.A., well, 10, 12 years ago, I was doing it a lot. I'm not a fan.
No.
I felt like it was a way at the time to get a co-star audition on a procedural show, if
right.
you're lucky. But sometimes it's the only outlet to do it. And I have had friends, and I've recommended people do one-on-ones, especially if they've got no other option. Get in front of a casting director, read for
yeah.
them. It's just too bad you have to pay to do it.
Talk to me about living at the Chelsea Hotel.
Oh, my God. So I was a New York actor in the 70s, and I was living in Los Angeles, too, and in the summer of 1978, I went to San Francisco. My agent told me that I needed to, oh, my God, this is before or after. I was just remembering that I was up for the role that Bruce Willis got in Moonlighting
oh,
at one
right.
point, but I was up doing Commedia dell'arte with Harry Hamlin at the Renaissance Fair in Marin County. My agent had told me at the time, you need to go to San Francisco and work on your chops, you know, do some more theater. And so I went up and I did this summer, which was, it was lovely, with a bunch of people from American Conservatory Theater. Anyway, while I was up there, I'm 24 years old, I met a bunch of punk rockers, including a man who today is one of my oldest and dearest friends, a musician named Alejandro Escovedo. Okay. And look him up. I mean, he's just, he's amazing. Anyway, a bunch of these punk rockers at the end of the summer said, we're moving to the Chelsea Hotel in New York. Now, I was never a punk rocker, but I pretended to be one. I mean, I was a preppy actor with wire-rimmed glasses and a tweed jacket, but I sure did like to party like those punk rockers. And so that's how I thought, you know, what the hell? I really didn't want to go back to L.A., so I moved with these punk rockers to the Chelsea Hotel the same week that Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen moved into the Chelsea Hotel.
Oh, my God.
And at the time, the Chelsea Hotel was like the zeitgeist of just sex, drugs, rock and roll, and a lot of fun. And I met David Bowie there. I hung out with Iggy Pop. And anyway, so I was there, and I was in the room. I was in Sid and Nancy's room the night of her murder. I was there about probably an hour, 2 hours before the murder happened.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's a story I live to tell. My contention is that Sid didn't kill her, and there's a lot of thought around that. But it was a wild and crazy time, you know, and I lived through it, and it's a great story, and it features in my one-man play, Del Valle.
Yes, so let's talk about that a little bit more. Is that autobiographical, semi-autobiographical?
Oh, yes, quite. In fact, somebody said, are you really sure you want to tell all this? And I said, well, yeah, okay. Yeah, it's autobiographical.
Because I read something in there about, you know, going to prison.
Well, yes. yeah, so the offshoot of when you live at the Chelsea Hotel with Sid and Nancy and you know, you sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the good news is that I've been sober for a number of years. I've been clean. But there was a time that, and I was living in Austin, Texas, where I got arrested for possession of drugs and ended up in jail at a place called Del Valle outside of Austin. And it's a great story. And I knew at the time, this is a great story. This is going to, you know, this is probably going to save my life. But, oh, my God, this is a great story. Because when I got there, the head of the Texas Aryan Brotherhood gang recognized me from One Life to Live, which is a soap opera I used to be on.
Yes.
That was good news because this guy, you know, could protect me in a very, you know, dangerous. I gotta
stop for just a second to point out the fact that a drug dealer watched soap operas.
Yeah, right. Well, not just a drug dealer. He was, I mean, no, all drug dealers watch soap operas. No, especially, you know, back in the day. No, this guy was an Aryan Nazi. I mean, he was a white supremacist.
Right.
He watched soap operas. I mean, he had his stories, his favorite ones. Yeah, he was a character. Yeah, anyway, so it's a great story. It's a great play, and I developed it. You know, I actually developed it at Naked Angels, and it was option. And then I did a workshop at the Atlantic Theater, and I went to London and did a workshop, and I performed it in Marfa, Texas. I got a grant to go do it there, and it's been optioned by a Broadway producer, and I just hooked up with a director and named Maria Mylif. So hopefully something's going to happen.
Talk to me about working with Bryan Cranston.
Probably one of the most genuinely wonderful, nice. I mean, I haven't worked with a lot of big stars, but I work with some, and most of them are really terrific because you become number one on the call sheet. You better be. And it's just, I mean, I used to audition against Bryan Cranston. You know, we're about the same age. And
I can see that
and,
as well.
And I used to be in the audition room in LA with him. And so I remember that, and I didn't know him at all, you know. I mean, but just to say hello. When I drove onto the parking lot at 6 a.m. in L.A. For shooting All the Way, he happened to be driving up at the same time. He got out of his car. He was like 2 rows away, and he looked over and he screamed, "Ned!" And I was like, "What?" You know.
Yeah.
And he went over, and he put his arm around me, and he took me to the trailer. I mean, it was, like, amazing. But he was like that, you know, he's like that. And I have friends that just worked with him on network on Broadway. And I mean, he's great. Yeah, I mean, it's just so great when you meet somebody or work with somebody and they're that amazing. What I got from him, I mean, you know, he has the freedom. It was interesting listening to your Kate Middleton interview, mm-hmm. talking about being a day player, you know, on TV and stuff. I mean, it is the most horrible job because you're like, you know, you're in your trailer reciting your two lines. And then you go out and, you know, nobody knows who you are. And if you're working with a James Spader or somebody like that, who is really terrific to the day players, to, you know, the guest stars, to, you know, you're lucky. But a lot of times that doesn't happen.
Right.
But with Bryan Cranston, I mean, he has the freedom to improvise. And anyway, we have this. I played a Senator Fulbright in All the Way, which was not a role in the play. It was beefed up for the movie, but we improvised. I mean, you know, it was the freedom to do that. And Jay Roach, the director, encouraged it. But I don't know. Bryan Cranston just gave me freedom to, you know, it came from the top. And I thought, okay, because a lot of times you can't do that, you know, like, right. especially. You know, if you have 2 days on a film, you better do the writer's words.
Yeah,
work yes. perfect. But
yes. Now, is there anything that you haven't done yet? And I'm not talking about specific roles per se, but just the types of roles. I mean, are you doing the type of work that you want to be doing?
I would have to say yes. I think now that I've grown into, my sister-in-law likes to say I've grown into my face. I am playing complex, sometimes evil characters. You know, I would love nothing more than to be a series regular on a fantastic New York-based series, right. you know. I think I'm headed where I've always wanted to be. I mean, it's funny because talking about moonlighting, I was up right. at that part at the time, and I didn't feel well. You mentioned the Hardy Boys, like in the Hardy Boys, I was 20 when I did that, and I didn't feel like I was there. I was playing an engineer and I was 20 and I was like, I didn't know what engineer meant. I mean, it was kind of like, and the same with, anyway, I feel like I've caught up to who I'm supposed to be. And, I've been around the block and it's fun showing that.
How was the journey when you first started at the beginning? What did you think it was going to be like in comparison to how it's gone?
Well, I thought that the road was paved with gold because it seemed like when I started, everything I touched turned to gold. It was kind of like, oh, here, you know, the doors would open, and until they didn't, until it was kind of like, oh, back then it wasn't so much about agents and managers so I thought it would be easier, and I've learned that, you know, it, and it's all relative. Like I said, you know, my pal Doris Roberts, after Everybody Loves Raymond ended, offers stopped coming in, so she had to get on that phone and call. And so you have to do that as an actor. You have to, and sometimes I just don't want to do that. Yesterday I was thinking, oh my God, there's this movie I want to get on now. And I know one of the producers, and it's kind of like, oh, but I just don't feel like having to sell myself. But, you know, I just shift that attitude, and, you know, they'd be lucky to get me and make that call. So it's, I think that's, it's always been that way, but I think an actor, myself in particular, you really do most of the work.
Well, Ned, I really want to thank you for taking the time to sit down and talk with me. It's been so great meeting you. I hope this isn't the last time we actually get to
you too,
sit down face
yeah,
to face.
Yeah.
This has been You May Have Seen with Ned Van Zandt. Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you.
Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if you'd like to leave a comment or review, that's always nice. You can also email us at youmayhaveseen@gmail.com if you have a comment or a question, and we'll give you a shout-out in the next episode.